This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The HBO series Big Love featured its final episode last night. I was kind of shocked by the ending. We're going to talk with the creators of the series, Mark Olson and Will Sheffer, about why it ended the way it did and what it's like to bring a series to a close after 5 seasons. Here's the spoiler alert. We're going to be giving away what happens at the end. So, if you haven't yet seen the finale of Big Love, but you plan to, don't listen to our interview today. It will be waiting for you on our website, freshair.npr.org. Big Love revolved around a polygamous family, Bill Hendrickson and his 3 wives, Barb, Nikki, and Margene. Bill grew up on a fundamentalist compound that practiced polygamy. Although he left the compound at age 14, he continued to believe in polygamy and live with his 3 wives in 3 adjoining homes in a suburb of Salt Lake. He co-owned a big box store called Home Plus, and in season 4, he got elected to the state senate. At the end of that season, he came out as polygamous. The consequences of coming out reverberated during season 5. He was facing 20 years in prison for statutory rape because his 3rd wife, Margene, neglected to tell him she was 16 when they married. And he was losing his store. Home life was very tense, his wives were fighting, and 2 of them wanted more independence. The deranged prophet of the compound where Bill grew up was trying to kill him, just 1 of the reasons Bill was trying to clean up the compounds. His larger mission was to reform polygamy by introducing a bill to legalize it and by starting his own church. My guests, Will Sheffer and Mark Olson, co-created Big Love and wrote the pilot and the finale. They've been a couple for 20 years. Let's start with a scene from the finale. Barb, the senior wife, feels strongly that she's been called to the priesthood and should have the power to administer blessings. But Bill thinks that this is a violation of their religion for a woman to have this power. This is the scene in which she reveals to Bill that she's planning to go against his wishes and get baptized in a reformed Mormon church that allows women to enter the priesthood. Bill's reaction is to start packing his bags.
You're getting baptized into the reformed church.
Yes. Well, I didn't know how to tell you, obviously, and I didn't think it would really change that much. Not really. Now what are you doing?
Going to Nikki's.
No, Bill, that's not right.
Not right? In the midst of this maelstrom, it's becoming obvious we don't have much in common. Marriage is about sharing. There's none of that going on between us except sharing problems, suspicions, and disrespect.
No, I've come to realize that it's unfair for me to expect you to compromise your deeply held beliefs, so why keep rubbing your nose in it? That's why I chose not to tell you. How much are you packing?
I don't know.
How long are you staying?
I don't know. Maybe this is just reality. Maybe things are shifting. Responsibilities lie elsewhere. Other children, other houses, other churches.
That's not fair. And this isn't right. I followed you into polygamy. And let me tell you, it was pretty alien from my beliefs. But I did it out of love.
We're back in the public eye in a big way. This will only be seen as your repudiation of us, of me. Now, at our most delicate time as a family, you just had to go and do this now.
Yes, now.
It's deliberately throwing a lit match on the gasoline.
If you're going to be gone for 1 year or 20, I need support. A spiritual home to draw strength from.
And it will destroy us.
How?
Your church is anti-polygamist. Church members are judged by their families, and you'll be judged and held back because of us. You'll be a chip plate, a second-class citizen. You'll be ashamed of your church for being intolerant of us and resentful of us for holding you back.
No, please.
The 2 nights I spent in jail, I didn't sleep. I wasn't thinking about rape or being arrested or the humiliation. I was thinking about us, you and me, and how we got to this place.
What am I supposed to do? You have 2 spouses to be with at night. I have none.
Will Sheffer, Mark Olson, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on the ending of Big Love, a great final episode. So there's so much to talk about. Now, you know, the question I kept asking myself toward the end was, how are you going to deal with the fact that each of the 3 wives is feeling very hemmed in by Bill, Barb thinks she's called to be a priest and administer blessings, which Bill opposes. Margene wants to enter the outside world and maybe do relief work. And even Nikki, who's the most traditional fundamentalist of the wives, wants to expand her life. And she's been working in a shelter for abused polygamous women. So all the wives seem to really move on and stop having to answer to Bill. And your resolution was to shoot Bill. Like at the last minute, he's shot and killed by a neighbor who's flipping out after the neighbor and his wife separated. And I didn't think of that at all. So can you tell us how you decided to resolve the conflicts between the wives and Bill by having Bill killed?
You know, it's a tough question because I'm having problems with the premise of the question.
Okay.
Because we approached that action of Bill's demise from a very different paradigm. We didn't feel, contrary to much of our viewing audience, that the wives were necessarily hemmed in by Bill. Barb and Bill, certainly this year, have had a fundamental disagreement about some theology. And it goes to the core, both of their cores, since this family is largely theologically based or you know, religiously based. But her love for him also endures. So I've never looked at it as everyone is chafing under Bill's authority, remove Bill from the equation, and the wives are okay. It was actually quite the opposite, that, believe it or not, we were trying to dramatize a family still, at the end of 5 years with all the ups and downs, that fundamentally continues to work. At the end of the day, this family is an institution that, in theory, we hope the audience, if not is rooting for, is at least invested in.
So why did you have to kill Bill to do that?
Well, believe it or not, we wanted Bill to go out a hero. We wanted him to go. I mean, they're on the most surface level. We wanted to give him sort of a Gary Cooper kind of exit from the show. But it went much deeper than that. In the writer's room at the beginning of this year, knowing that we were going to be wrapping it up, we were looking down the road. And we didn't want Bill to go out a loser or a failure or, you know, an unrepentant fundamentalist. And we wanted to find that thing which would render his life's existence the most successful. And we felt by far the greatest testimony to Bill would be that he had created a family that endured. And we felt the best way to establish that would be to remove him from the equation via Carl, and find out that a year later, 2 years later, these women are still bound together or bonded deeply in something like a family. So that was the whole reason. That was the whole raison d'etre for Bill's demise.
The ending is very much about sisterhood. You know, the three wives stay together and seem closer than ever. Was that a big part of the equation when you were figuring out how do we end this thing?
Absolutely. I mean, for me, I think the big secret of the show, which I think a lot of people got at the beginning, but some people were late to understanding, is that it's always been a feminist show. And that, you know, even though it was dramatizing this very patriarchal system, that, you know, the show was really about sisterhood. And it was one of the things that drew us to the material in the first place and gave us reason to want to explore it. Because apart from all the crimes and against women that are committed on the compounds and the nature of the system, which is inherently patriarchal, we felt that there were opportunities for women to actually find support in one another. And it was a large part of the literature and the interviews that we took part in, that you heard a lot of that from Sister Wives. And it was a fundamentally fascinating dichotomy, you know, that we felt was very interesting.
And not only did we know that going into it, but as writers, sometimes you discover things through, you know, gifts that the actors or actresses bring to the material. But sometimes your pens, or now your fingers on a keyboard, tell you where the heat is, tell you what's really true about something. And there's no denying that, I think, for certainly for Will and I, but for every writer who ever set foot in the Big Love writers' room, those wives scenes, we call them the wives meeting scenes, where everyone has their calendars and their planners and whatnot, they're just the heart and soul. They're the heart and soul of any given episode, and somewhat of the series itself. They I don't want to say they write themselves, but there's great joy in crafting those. And you just know from the minute those words hit the keyboard that that's where the gold is, and that's where the strength, so much of the core of this family and this material is.
Now, I just have to interrupt here and say that in the final season, there was so much dissension within the family. I thought the family was falling apart. I thought Barb was going to leave for several reasons. One is, I mean, she just wanted to be more independent, and it was very hard for her to be that way. She wanted to be a priestess, and she couldn't. And there was so much resentment between a couple of the wives, and, you know, Nikki was being more weird and more unpleasant than ever. And I think if people are just, who don't know the series, are just listening to you talk, you'd think it was this, like, really harmonious family, and things, I thought things were just, like, falling apart at the end. There was so much conflict.
You know, and most people have felt that. I have to say, we are aware that most people have felt that. And it surprised me to a certain extent that every time there would be some, and I understand there's degrees of discord, but every time there's a whiff of discord in the family, people are opining, oh, they're going to leave. Oh, they're going to bail. This one's about to bail. And you know, Will and I have never looked at it like that. We've never played the who's going to leave the marriage game because I think we have a firm belief that, to a certain extent, has been called into question by everyone's response to this material, that you stick it out, you know, that marriage is worth sticking out. And you know, there's a family here, there's a relationship here, there's love beneath the acrimony, there's certainly connection, and there's certainly identity. And we've always felt that the hardest thing in the world is to forge that independence in a marriage. You know, not to leave it and find it on the other side of that, but to try and find that in union, and in marriage. So yes, Barb and Bill went at it hammer and tong, and Nikki was a rag this year. But I think, honestly, my favorite scene of the finale and perhaps of the series is that little car ride that Barb and the girls go on in the finale. It's just because it says it all. It says it all. Nikki is just as sour as can be in that back seat, and Margene is as loving as she can be, and all their problems are there, but you see the love that exists.
And I have to, you know, chime in and say that for us, the show has been about staking out a marriage. Yeah, we've thrown everything at this family, and certainly, you know, a person's independence and personhood is one of the most fundamental rights and the most fundamental values, I think, in life. And so I think that there's been this kind of shift in American culture where there's this idea that you can't have that unless you separate, divorce, go off on your own. And for us, marriage, we've been together 20 years, and marriage is important, and it's a key value in our life. And we struggle with those issues.
I got to interrupt. I appreciate what you're saying. Your relationship, the one that you have with each other, I assume is a relationship of equality, which is not the relationship in Big Love. You have three women who on some level have to answer to the husband. They have to share the husband. He sees himself as the final arbiter of what the women are allowed to do. He has to give them permission to be free if they want to be, you know, independent. He's the wage earner. He's the decision maker. He's the final authority. He's the power broker. It's not a relationship of equals.
No, it's not. I mean, and that's what we've dramatized, and we've pushed that, we've questioned that essential structure to its limit. And I think that, you know, one thing that we're positing in this finale is that what would have happened if this structure were allowed to develop outside of the shadows, outside of the compound?
The structure meaning polygamy.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that we posit, you know, in this final year especially, and I don't think we necessarily make any final judgments about it. But look, in a way, this show has been a metaphor for marriage, period. And that essential value of staying and struggling it through. Look, we're not saying that people on the compound and women on the compound should stay in this kind of structure, but that this particular relationship that we've chosen to dramatize, this particular family in the context that we've created for them, we've seen them begin to grow and change in ways that we didn't necessarily expect.
Clearly, I don't think we ever want to be considered poster boys for the fact that if you're born in an abusive relationship, you endure and there's value in that. Because I don't think that's really what the show is. But we have been dramatizing the evolution and change in a fundamentalist patriarchal family from year one to year five. And we've been watching them, all of them, you know, struggle with their roles and the relationship of power and whatnot. As Bill, as a patriarch, you're quite right. He does hold the cards, but there's growth in the guy. And that's kind of what we're looking at is the growth in that family.
Spoiler alert, we're talking about last night's final episode of the HBO series Big Love. My guests are the co-creators of the series, Will Sheffer and Mark Olson. The series ended with Bill, the main character, getting shot to death by his neighbor.
So what was it like when you told Bill Paxton that his character was going to be shot to death in the final episode? Like, were you in the room? Did you tell him, or were you in the room with him when he read the script so you could see the look on his face?
We were in the room when Bill read the script, and we had all of our main key actors. We gave them the red pages, as they were called. Mark and I gave them personally, and we were sitting with them while they read them. Bill wasn't happy.
Bill had trouble with it. Bill had trouble with the fact that his character was going to die. It's not how he envisioned the end of his character's journey, nor the end of the series. And he just had a big problem with it. I think it worked on a lot of levels, but I just think he had a vested relationship in the character of Bill Henriksen. He feels, and rightfully so, that he has husbanded that character for 5 years, and it hurt him to know that that character was going to die. It hurt him. We explained what we're going for, and he got it. He heard that. But it took about a week or two for Bill to come around and see it differently.
So if Bill Paxton didn't want his character to be shot to death, if he thought that that was a mistake, do you know how he envisioned the ending? What were the alternative endings he saw in his mind?
Well, kind of. Because it's what he wanted every year, and he wanted more of it. I think literally he wanted he and the wives to go head off into the sunset together. Maybe if they were all on horses and had cowboy hats. He's always had this very romantic vision, and I mean that in a good way, of he and his wives. I think it stunned Bill himself to find out that so many women across America were angry at him and his character. No, it did. I think it hurt his feelings. And I think he was surprised. To varying degrees, Will and I were surprised at that response as well. But he's always had this vision of Bill and these wives kind of as rock stars, as the Beatles. And he wanted them to go on in a very kind of romantic way.
In the writer's room, when you were trying to figure out what is the ending going to be, did you all agree, yes, absolutely, Bill, the patriarch of the family, is going to be shot to death. That's what we're going to do. Or were there alternate endings that were proposed that you considered and then decided to reject?
I remember that when this idea, kind of fully, that we knew we were going to end it this year, and that we had this kind of ending in sight that people were generally, and the wives would go on afterwards, that was the epilogue that we always envisioned. Everyone was pretty supportive and on board with it is what I remember. And, I know we ran it by HBO to just make sure that they were behind it ending this way. And they were very supportive. They loved it. And then we had second guesses, should we really do this? And it was like that kind of backstepping that you do. But we were well into having conceived the last year and sort of dotted all the I's and crossed the T's, that we started to think, is this really, do we really want to do this? But I think at the beginning of our writing period this year, when we said, this is what we want to do now, it's time, everyone was pretty on board.
Yeah, Will's right. We staked out that territory. Like a lot of the major decisions that we've done story-wise on this show, it kind of bursts out of one of us. It lands almost fully formed, And we stick to it. I remember very vividly. We were driving home on a section of the 210 highway And then before the writers, and we were in the writers' room, and we were just batting ideas. If it's the last season, how's it going to end? And I have to say, I think Will's the one who came up with Bill dies, the wives stick together. I mean, it was just that simple and that clean. And that has always been the touchstone, the lodestar. As Will says, once you come up with a theory, once you come up with a goal, you'll spend months second-guessing it. There were a good three-week period where we were evaluating, no, maybe actually Barb gets cancer again. And by like episode 9 or 10, we had this incredibly moving scenario where she goes to Oregon, the family goes to Oregon to see Sarah one last time. Barb's gone through the ravages of chemo. And the wives and Bill let her go in the Pacific Ocean. Yeah, we toyed a lot of stuff. But it always kept coming back to, no, that stronger gut, that trumps. That original instinct just tends to trump. It all makes sense with that choice.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Mark Olson and Will Sheffer, the creators of the HBO series Big Love, which concluded its fifth and final season last night. So consider this a spoiler alert. The series revolved around a polygamous family, Bill Hendrickson and his wives Barb, Nikki, and Margene. Bill grew up on a fundamentalist compound run by a self-appointed prophet who considered himself the leader of the true Mormons, although the Mormon Church totally disavowed the group and its polygamous practices. Bill left the compound when he was 14, but continued to believe in polygamy. Let's hear the scene Mark Olson described as perhaps his favorite scene from the finale. Barb has traded in her old station wagon for a new sporty convertible, something totally out of character for such a practical woman. In this scene, Barb takes her two sister wives for a drive on the highway in her new car. Barb and Margene love the sense of freedom. The disapproving Nikki is in the back seat.
Oh, it's cramped back here. I figured I didn't need the extra space since I'm no longer hauling kids and groceries full time. My responsibilities have changed, as both you and Bill keep reminding me.
Make it go really fast!
Where do you want to go? Downtown?
No, out of town. Past the airport, way, way out.
Can you put the top up, please?
Just relax. Enjoy the ride. It's the last time we'll all be together for the first time in Honeybee.
You named your impractical little car Honeybee?
Mm-hmm.
I'd think In Your Face would be a better name.
All right, everyone, be quiet. Let's go.
Now, there's a lot of other things that have happened in this season and in previous seasons where I wonder, when did you know that this was a trait of the character? For example, in this season, in this final season, we learned that Margene, who's the youngest of the wives, was actually underage when she married Bill. She was only 16, which means that when she was 16 and consummating the relationship with Bill, it was statutory rape legally. And Bill is shocked. He didn't know she was 16. She had kept that hidden. And he's actually being charged with statutory rape and facing up to 20 years in prison. When did you, the creators and writers of the show, know that Margene was underage? Did you know that in season one?
Yeah, I'm trying to protect ourselves in this answer, so it doesn't seem like we're
what do you need
we're
protection?
Well, yeah. So it doesn't seem like we're seat of the pants, fly by night, anything goes kind of guys. But yeah, truthfully, no, we did not know that. We learned that, as it were, midpoint through the season. We were cracking the Christmas episode in the writer's room. Will was not part of the writer's room at that process. He was off in his office doing a draft of our season opener. So he was absent from most of our discussions as we were doing our infamous Christmas episode. And we had all the stories there. We had it all laid out. But the engine wasn't turning over. There was something fundamentally wrong. Yeah, Will and I come from large families, and particularly on my side, they're very messy Christmases. There was a kind of mess that had not quite landed yet in that episode. And I remember going back to Will's office going, we've got to send Jamie out to draft. We've got to send her out to outline, but it's not quite there. What's missing? And Will just out of the blue blurts out, Marge revealed she was 16 when they got married. Yeah, and it was one of those things. Yes, it was in the very, very in the moment, but in the best possible way, that it not only turned over that episode, it made sense of the season, it made sense of that character, it just made sense of everything. And one of the art, Will was talking about it a few moments ago. You discover more as you go along about the characters. You certainly have your roadmap, but many things happen on the way to Rome, and you can go off in different directions, as we certainly have. But you're always trying to fill in backstory. You allow yourself that freedom. You allow certain undelineated areas of character to exist to become hosts of material as you go forward, so that the creative process remains alive and vivid, and you're not just doling out consequences of pre-existing facts. So, short answer, on the one hand, it was very in the moment, but on the other, it was one of those things that felt just inevitable the second it came out of Will. It felt like this inevitable thing that we were lucky enough to receive, you know, in time to harness it.
Now, let me ask you another question about when you knew about a certain plot development or personality trait, character trait in Big Love. Albie, who a great character in the series and a great performance by Matt Ross, Albie starts off the series as the son of the self-proclaimed prophet of the fundamentalist compound. And he's a self-proclaimed prophet, he's a cult leader, and he's no good. He's a really evil guy. And Albie, the son, becomes more and more evil and may I say, demented as the series goes on. And he's responsible for crimes and sadistic acts. But we also learn he's a very repressed, deeply in the closet homosexual who happens to be living his life as a polygamist heterosexual. The reality and the truth of who he is aren't getting along very well. And obviously being eaten alive by that. When did you guys know that Albie was a deeply closeted, repressed homosexual?
I think we knew that from the beginning. It was sort of, I don't think we knew the behavior as well as we kind of learned it in the first year, because he, you know, I think that's when we start to establish this kind of specific ways that he, you know, kind of behaves as a repressed gay man in this particular context of this, you know, horrible fundamentalist life on a compound.
Well, it was baked into the DNA of that character and the show. That character was always intended to be represent the ascension of Warren Jeffs in Colorado City. And although nothing has ever been proven, to my mind, Warren Jeffs has always had a certain effeminate air that comes off him. It's just it's what he exudes, and we borrowed that. I mean, we knew that. We knew that was part of what Matt was doing. It was part of why we cast him. Part of what he presented that was so interesting. And there was a long discussion. There was a long, deeply collaborative discussion with HBO if we really wanted to go in this direction with this character. And we said absolutely.
I'm wondering if the connection that you made between Albie's repressed homosexuality and his sadism and brutality was challenged by some viewers, particularly gay viewers, who might feel that back in the days when homosexuality was considered a pathology and was even defined medically as a pathology, in some movies, if you were gay and you were repressed, that would explain, you know, you were evil. There was something evil that you were going to express during the course of the film. And I think some people are really uncomfortable with that.
Yeah, I think that's a totally valid point. I do. And it's one that we entertained a lot when we were discussing the direction to take Albie's character. Do we want to use this as a vehicle to dramatize someone who is repressed and finds a way through that thicket to claim their soul and to claim their ultimate identity? Which is a very valid choice, even in that world. You know, there's many not that Mormons are fundamentalists themselves, but there's many gay ex-Mormons who have gone through really hard times and certainly stand for the proposition that that is a valid dramatic choice. But I think we felt that the other choice was something that we were much more interested in nailing in this particular material. And I don't think I would rephrase the question a little bit, or the assumption behind the question. Mm-hmm. It's not so much that because one is repressed, one is are gay and repressed, one is evil, back to the 50s pathology. But I do think Will and I are basically comfortable that if one is gay and repressed, there is a certain tragedy to that in the same way that any soul that does not find its expression, does not find its purpose in life's expression and a degree of authenticity, whatever that lid is that's placed on top of them is a tragic lid, and the life lived on the other side of it will be to greater or lesser degree somewhat in a shadow or a fraction of what the fullest expression of that soul could become.
I think, you know, I have to say that, you know, we're middle-aged gay men, and, you know, we were born into a 70s kind of culture. Vito Russo's book about the stereotypical, behavior of gay characters in popular culture was, you know, on our radar, our reading list, and it was something that we were completely a part of. And so I think that making a piece of popular culture in 2007, when we kind of were fully invested in Big Love, we had come through a lot of iterations of the portrayal of gays in popular culture, you know, over the years. And so we thought we were doing something kind of subversive and fresh and exciting by portraying a gay character in this context who was still being so abused by a culture and so repressed that people still kill themselves, you know, which was always a kind of critique that we kind of had against a lot of versions of popular culture, like the Children's Hour in the 50s, you know. And I think that, you know, what we thought we were doing and what we were excited about was in this particular culture, the conditions aren't unlike the 1950s, you know, and so people do still kill themselves. People are separated from the mainstream enough so that they don't value themselves as gay men and women. And there are these kind of conditions that still result in this kind of horrible repression that Albie's impossible life, dramatizes. So we thought we were kind of saying, look, guys, we've been through this. You know, we've lived through this. We've seen popular culture hopefully move on from this, but it's still happening in certain places in America.
In the final episode of the previous season, of the penultimate season of Big Love, the character of Bill comes out publicly as a polygamous man. This is right after he wins the election for state senate. And that public coming out, the repercussions of that play throughout the final episode. As gay men yourselves, did you have any kind of coming out experiences that you let reverberate in Bill's coming out as a polygamist, not to compare homosexuality and polygamy, but there's still this sense of this, like, you know, public coming out?
I think that, you know, there's a certain point as a gay man, as a gay artist, as someone who's sort of coming to terms with themselves and coming to terms with what they want to do in the world, where, you know, at a certain point, it's not enough to be private about it. It's not enough to sort of hold it inside and go through one's life without telling one's parents, one's family, one's community. And, something that becomes almost essential to your soul that it's expressed, you know. And in order to be a whole person, you feel like you've got to state it, and you've got to state it publicly. And that's something that I think became important to Bill's character. And I think that was something that you saw him make a decision about, not only for political reasons, where he felt like polygamy was being misrepresented by the compounds and the public. I'm talking about the fictional world, you know, the way that the compounds were representing polygamy in the public eye, that he had to make a statement about what he felt his family meant, and he had to sort of put another persona on polygamy.
I think the decision that we made fourth season for Bill, the character, to make an assessment of his life and determine, you know what, I'm running for office because I'm going to take this platform, a public platform, and declare who we are and put a new face on polygamy. I think it comes from, well, certainly if I can speak to my life and the issues that relate to and the surus engendered by keeping the secret. It becomes overwhelming. As the years accrete and you're still compartmentalizing and you're still trying to juggle who knows, who doesn't know, how do I keep these separate factions apart and how do I keep them from not speaking to it? You know, it just, and that was Bill's life. That was what he had come to. And he made an assessment that the problems that he was facing in his family were to a certain extent related to that secret keeping. And Will's right. You know, it was gilded with other colors. He didn't want the public face of polygamy to be determined by the face of the compounds. In the same way that we kind of look at each other, and it's like, must the gay pride parade begin with the float with the transvestites? You know, can't it begin with the businessmen? You know, so yes, there's a lot of other colors that go into it and the impulses. But I think anyone who's pushed into that corner and is keeping those deep personal secrets about something that goes to the very core of who they are just has that inexorable impulse to be free of it.
So you've been married for 20 years, and gay marriage has been legal a much shorter time than that. So when you were married 20 years ago, was that a religious ceremony or an improvised ceremony?
There's 2 days. There's June 21st. Mark moved into Will's apartment, and which was what 1991, 1990,
yeah,
whatever
it was. Like almost 20 years ago.
And then when there was the brief window here in California, we actually just about moments before the November election on Prop 8, we had a Justice of the Peace quickly assemble in our editor's room and made it official.
Yeah, we had, claimed domestic partnership and at City Hall way early into our relationship. So I think we've thought of ourselves as married, and as the kind of debate has, kind of raged around us, we've made our own determination of how important marriage was to us as a couple and what kind of vows and contractual elements we wanted to put into place and what kind of standing before our family and our community and before, God and the universe that we wanted to have in terms of this commitment we have to each other.
Before God, the universe, and HBO.
So, Big Love just ended after 5 seasons. I'm going to miss the characters, will you?
Desperately.
Very nice.
Will, you have not earned the right to say that. You know, just 2 months ago, you were like, I don't want a 6 year. I'm so sick of these characters. And I'm like,
I didn't say I was sick of the characters. I said,
Don't go there.
Tired of writing the show.
All right.
I love the characters.
Yeah. You know what? We're going through withdrawal right now. At least I am. I'll speak for myself. Those characters, particularly when you're running a show and taking it this distance, they are in your head 24/7. Yeah, you're on the toilet. The characters are talking in your head. You're shaving. The characters are in your head. You're doing the dishes. You're talking to the characters. They live with you. In your soul, they are as real as any member of my family. As real or realer than the friends I once had when I had time for friends before the series began. And so it's a wrenching process to let go of them. We love them desperately.
Yeah, I didn't know how hard it was going to be to wrap it up. I remember around episode 7 before we had, kind of revealed the ending to the actors, some of the other producers would come in and they'd be a little bit mopey and I'd be like, what are you talking about? We got a show to put on, people, I just was really kind of not feeling it. And then when we got as soon as we told the actors, I think it was around episode 8 or around then, out of 10, I just had the most difficult time. I mean, Mark will tell you I was crying nonstop from that point on. And it was just much more wrenching than I ever imagined it would be to give up the characters, and give up the show.
So one more question. You've been together for 20 years. You're married. Is doing a series together good for a relationship? Would you recommend other couples try it?
It depends on the couple. Certainly, it's been good for us. And I think it sort of goes towards what we've been saying. It's been difficult. I wouldn't have it any other way, certainly. I think it's forged us. And I don't think we'd be the couple we are had we not had this experience together.
I would also say, though, you it's not for the faint of heart. And you better have your ducks in a row before you enter into it.
Thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you so much for the series.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Thank you.
Mark Olson and Will Sheffer co-created the HBO series Big Love, which ended its 5th and final season last night. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward reviews a reissue of Nick Lowe's album Labor of Lust, which was first released in 1979. This is Fresh Air. In the upheavals that have rocked the music business over the past couple of decades, countless albums that were once considered essential or classic have gotten lost. Nick Lowe's second album, Labor of Lust, was released in 1979 and has been out of print for nearly 20 years. Yep Rock Records has remedied that situation with a new reissue, and rock historian Ed Ward has a review.
Simultaneously with the rediscovery of Nick Lowe's classic 1979 album Labor of Lust, someone's dug up an old British television documentary which was shot in Eden Studios, as Lowe recorded, and posted it on YouTube. The film, titled Born Fighters, has been chopped into 12 tiny pieces, which makes it hard to watch, but it shows the intensity Lowe put into the project. There were four musicians involved, Dave Edmonds and Billy Bremner on guitars, Lowe on bass, and Terry Williams on drums. And depending on who had the most recent album out, they toured as either Dave Edmonds in Rockpile or Nick Lowe in Rockpile. The reputation they had as one of the tightest bands around was, as I can attest from having seen them several times, well-deserved. Band was their ability to, as it were, speak punk without being punk. Edmonds' part of the band stuck closer to more traditional classic rock and roll, but Lowe already had the reputation of having produced bands like The Damned, as well as his protege, Elvis Costello. The British press may have said snide things about their being too old to play like that. The liner notes say their average age was an ancient 32. But the British press was always saying snide things, and the proof was in the grooves. Labor of Lust was something of a crucial test for Lowe. His British record company, Radar, had signed a deal with Columbia in the U.S., where radio's resistance to the new music of the late 70s was at a high point. His first album, called Jesus of Cool in the U.K., but retitled Pure Pop for Now People for the American market, was just that, pure pop. But although a couple of singles were pulled from it, they flopped. Greg Giller, who was overseeing the new album for Columbia, asked Lowe to include a song he'd recorded with his old band, Brinsley Schwartz, and it turned out to make all the difference. Cruel to Be Kind was, and remains, Lowe's biggest U.S. hit, peaking at 12 on the Billboard chart, not coincidentally because a brand new television channel, MTV, showed its video, which was shot at Lowe's wedding to Carlene Carter, part of the extended Johnny Cash family. Some of us had already heard a single Lowe had recorded with Elvis Costello's band, released in England, and which showed up on the album, which could well have been about her. I made an American squirm, and it felt so
deep, deep into the night. It goes on and on and on.
Johnny Cash was a fan of his new son-in-law and would soon record his version of one of Labor of Lust's best songs. Without love, I am half human. Without love, I'm more machine. Without love, there's nothing doing. I will die without love. Without love, I am an island all by myself in the heartbreak sea. Without love, there's no denying I am dying without love. For there is nowhere I can run, and there is no hiding place. Sticking out like a soft thumb by the gloomy look upon my face. Without love. In the end, Nick Lowe proved to be more of an album artist than a singles artist. He's had a long and fruitful career, and this is the record which established him. It's good to have it back.
Ed Ward lives in the south of France. He blogs at wardinfrance.blogspot.com. He reviewed the reissue of Nick Lowe's album, Labor of Lust. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.
Sweatspot Susan, won't you give me a line?
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne Rebaldonato, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
I keep on trying.